so delighted to be here and have such a warm welcome by all of you, and I hope we all get to stay warm tonight before we have to go back out into the cold. So I'm going to be talking tonight about cryptography, how to keep a secret. So how many of you have seen ever the television show Numbers? It's no longer being shown, but it was...
It was so good.
So I was a consultant for the show Numbers for a short period of time, and the benefit that I had for doing that, in addition, you know, so they would send me the scripts, and I would send back comments that they would then ignore. And you can actually read my experience about that in the MAA Focus. I wrote a little article about my experience consulting for Numbers. If you go to my website, there's a link to that, or get a copy of the MAA Focus. But you can see here, so at one point they said, well, we'd like some background, some mathematics to put in the background of a scene on the blackboard. Can you give me some mathematics? And they said, well, does it have to have anything to do with that episode? And they said, no, not really. So unfortunately, this is coming out much darker than it is on my screen, so I'm not sure that you can really see it. But you can see maybe the word, and you'll see it maybe better on the next screen. So the word Cayley here, which I'll talk about a little bit later in the talk, and there's some equations. Let's see if the next one is maybe a little bit clearer. So you can see Cayley, C-E-I-L-I-D-H, which you'll see later, and some equations that come from some joint work that a colleague and I did on something we called the Cayley public key crypto system. And so the equations are there, and in fact, so this is a very popular television show, and there was a mathematician in Belgium who saw that and said, I know that, that's the Cayley crypto system. It was named after that cat Cayley. And you can actually read on his blog about how he, you know, people have actually seen it. It was only up there for a few seconds. There were only a few screen captures you can do for that. And to prove that I actually had something to do with this, there's me with two of the stars of the show. So you can read more about my adventures. I guess I called it Alice in Numberland. Read more about that. Okay, so what is crypto? So we'll talk a little bit about the cryptography that was on the blackboard a little later. But so what is cryptography, first of all? So the word comes from the Greek, so cryptos meaning hidden and graphia meaning writing. So cryptography is about secret writing, so in other words, sending secret messages. And I'm going to give you a very, very brief and somewhat biased history of cryptography that will relate to what I'm talking about today. So we'll first talk about private key cryptography, which is something that goes back many, many years. I'm sort of arbitrarily giving the year 1900 BC because some people did that as the year, but you know, I don't think anybody really knows when that started. And then the more modern cryptography that uses some of the mathematics that we'll be talking about today was public key cryptography from around the mid-1970s, elliptic curve cryptography from the mid-1980s, and then much more recently, pairing-based cryptography and torus-based cryptography, of which that Cayley public key crypto system was the first thing that we actually called torus-based cryptography. Okay, so going back historically, why did I have this year 1900 BC? Well, so some people claim that there was an Egyptian who used non-standard hieroglyphs to hide a secret message in a carved monument, and that this is the first documented example of written cryptography. But presumably cryptography has actually been around a lot longer, and we just don't have the documentation for that. A very well-known example is the Caesar cipher. So Julius Caesar used the method, a very simple method of encrypting secret messages, which is that you shift the text by three letters. So for example, if we have the English word very, you would shift, so you do it letter by letter, you take the V, you shift by three letters, so V, W, X, Y, so V becomes Y, E, F, G, H, so E becomes H, R becomes U, and then for Y, what do? Well, you cycle back around, so Y, Z, A, B, so Y becomes B. So it's clear how to encrypt, you shift everything forward by three letters, and then to decrypt, you shift everything back by three letters. So in some sense, the secret key that the two parties share is the fact that you're shifting by three. So this is private key cryptography, or it's often called symmetric key cryptography. The two parties that are doing the encryption and decryption are sharing a secret key. In this case, the key is shift by three. And the people who know that that's the secret key can encrypt and decrypt, and other people would have more trouble doing it. Another example is Mary, Queen of Scots, who, when she was in prison, she encrypted her letters. They were smuggled out in kegs of ale, but these, unfortunately, were intercepted and then decrypted, leading to rather unfortunate results for Mary, Queen of Scots. So private key cryptography. In private key cryptography, as I've said, two people communicate with each other using a shared secret. So symmetric key cryptography, they have the same secret. It's a symmetric situation. The problem with private key cryptography, or a problem with it, is that they have to exchange the secret in advance somehow, in some way that nobody else knows the secret. So maybe there's a code book. And so they would use the shared secret. One of them would use the shared secret to encrypt the message, and the other would use the shared secret to decrypt the message. But then you have the problem that code books can be stolen. So, for example, in World War II, I think one way, well, so there were clever techniques that the Allies used to decrypt the messages of the Germans, but in fact, another technique, I believe, was that they would do things like sink the submarine and steal the code books or steal the machine that was used to encrypt or whatever. So there are problems with private key cryptography in terms of how do you exchange the secret message, how do you keep the code books safe. So an example of private key cryptography is the one-time pad. Now, a very recent invention in cryptography, and according to Ron Rivest, a very important one, was the invention of Alice and Bob. So this was due to Ron Rivest, who's very proud of it. The idea in cryptography, you always have to have two parties that have to be called Alice and Bob. So I guess the idea was, one male, one female, so you can refer to them as he and she, and it'll be unambiguous. And an A and a B and a one-syllable and a two-syllable, and a Y and a one-syllable and a two-syllable. Anyway, I always bring the Alice with me to the lecture, and there are often Bobs in the audience, although not always. I've had audiences with 300 women, and there were no Bobs. So are there Bobs in the audience? Okay, so we have a Bob in the audience. So suppose Bob and I, so in one-time pad, what happens is that Bob and I will share some large random secret number. So let's call the secret number S, and that's the one-time pad. And suppose I have some message, and I'd like to send it to Bob. So I somehow convert my message to a number using some publicly known way to go back and forth between messages and numbers. I convert my message to a number that I'll call M. And then I take my message M and I add it to the shared secret S. And then I get something that I call C, some number C, and that's the ciphertext. And then I can send the ciphertext to Bob. The rest of you could intercept this, but you can't figure out what the original message is because you don't know the secret. Bob can figure out the original message because he takes the ciphertext, he subtracts our shared secret, and he gets the original message. So that's a very simple system. So the one-time pad, we have a shared secret message. The encryptor adds the secret The encryptor adds that secret to the message to get the ciphertext. The decryptor takes the ciphertext, subtracts the shared secret, and gets the plain text that I can get. The one-time pad is provably the only completely secure encryption scheme. So as long as you don't use the secret again, so that's what makes a one-time pad, you can only use it once, as long as you never reuse the secret, it's provably secure and it's in fact the only provably secure encryption scheme. So the problem is that then you have these secrets that can only be used once. How do you exchange them? How do you keep it secret? So this can be cumbersome or even impossible because code books can be stolen or they can be compromised. So that's where public key cryptography comes in. So in public key cryptography, you're doing this what's seemingly impossible. So at some point, I think people believe this couldn't actually be done, where two people can share a secret or maybe encrypt a message even if they've never communicated before. So there's no need to exchange code books or secrets in advance. So you can imagine where this would be useful. Suppose you want to buy a book at Amazon.com. Well, you don't want to have to go to Amazon headquarters and get a shared secret that you can then use when you go back home. You want to somehow be able to create a shared secret that you can do remotely, and then use this shared secret to maybe encrypt your credit card over the internet so that other people can't read it. So you can think about how would that be done if you haven't exchanged, how would you exchange a shared secret if you don't have a secure channel to them? What would you do? So the example that I like to give that I actually read in an airline magazine once is the example, a very simple scenario that I think gives a good explanation for the idea of public key cryptography. So suppose, Bob and I haven't met, right? Bob, we haven't met before, right? Okay, we have met before. I forgot. Suppose that, so Bob is somewhere far away, and I want to send him something valuable. And I have a box, and I have some collection of locks, and I have keys that work on my locks. And the rule of the game is that if you send something in an unlocked box, it will always be stolen. So suppose that Bob also has a bunch of locks and keys that only open his locks. Is there some way that I can send this valuable package, this valuable gift to Bob? Can that be done? So using this scenario. So can I somehow get it there in a locked box in such a way that he can open it? So how many people, first of all, have seen this? Raise your hand if you've seen this problem before. And okay, so you're not allowed to say anything. The rest of you, can you try to work this problem out? So how would this work? Any suggestions? How would we get started? So I want to send Bob valuable package. So people who already know this don't tell anything. Anyone want to sign?
Sure.
So what's the first step? What should we do first?
Why don't you get Bob to send you an unlocked lock?
Okay, so Bob could send me an unlocked lock, but how can he do that? If he puts it in an unlocked box, it will get stolen. So he could put it in a locked box, but then I can't open it. So you see there's a problem there, right? Okay, how do we solve that? Okay, so here, can you share that with the rest of us? What should we do? Suggestions?
Oh, well, couldn't you lock it the first time, send it over to
Okay, so I lock it with empty or with something in it?
Empty.
Okay, so let's say I have an empty box, I lock it. Okay. And I send it to Bob. Then what happens?
Then they put a lock on and send it back.
Okay.
And then the next person unlocks it.
So then I unlock it.
Actually, no, put something in it the first time, and then send it back over.
Okay, so first step. So you're suggesting we put the valuable package in, I lock it with one of my locks, I send it to Bob. Somebody else want to tell me the second step? Yes?
I'm sorry, I had it a second ago. I just lost it.
Somebody else then.
Bob locks it.
Bob puts one of his locks on and locks it.
Now it's got two locks, right?
So now it has two locks. So now it looks as if the problem, it's even worse. Now it's double locked. And there's nobody who can unlock both of those locks. So then what happens? He locks it, sends it back to me, and what happens? What do?
You unlock your lock.
I unlock my lock, so it's only now locked with Bob's lock, and what do I do next?
Send it back.
Send it back to Bob, he unlocks it, and he has the present. Okay, so that is basically the idea of public key cryptography. I managed to solve this problem to get the valuable package to Bob. Even though we haven't met before, we haven't exchanged, I don't have any keys that work on his locks, he doesn't have any keys that work on my locks. And that's basically the idea of public key cryptography. Okay, so public key cryptography is based on one-way functions. A one-way function is something that's easy to do and hard to undo. So in the example that we just gave, the one-way function was locking the lock. So that's something that is very easy for me to lock an open lock. But you can only unlock it if you happen to have the key. So that's a one-way function, locking a lock. If you don't have the key, it's hard to unlock. Another example is breaking a plate. If I take a plate, smash it on the floor, shatters into many pieces, well, that was easy to do. The hard thing is putting it back together. So that's another example of a one-way function. So a one-way function is something that's easy to do and hard to undo. And I'm sure you can think of lots of things in your life that were very easy to do and that you wish you had done, that are hard to undo, that are hard to take back. Okay, so unfortunately it's not very practical to do cryptography by breaking plates. So we need something that may, something a little bit better, something that maybe computers can do. So if you're going to, buy a book from Amazon, you don't want to have to break too many plates. You want to be able to maybe send something via a computer. So you want to replace the broken plates with some mathematics, with number theory. It turns out that that's the easiest solution, or maybe the only solution that people knew for how to do this. So I'm fond of saying, because I'm a number theorist, I'm fond of saying that number theory is the backbone of public key cryptography. And I keep asking cryptographers, is it really fair to say that? And they say, yeah, that's basically true. Number theory is the backbone of public key cryptography. And public key cryptography is an important real-world application of theoretical mathematics. So there was some idea for many years that number theory was the purest of the pure fields of mathematics. It would never, I mean, G.H. Hardy said something about how this was something that would never have applications. In particular, it would never be used in warfare, and it wasn't that wonderful, the beauty and purity of number theory. But in fact, he was very quickly proved wrong, that number theory has, you know, for good or for bad, it has important real-world applications in, you know, for cryptography. Okay, so so public key cryptography, well, in the public world, was due to Whit Diffie and Marty Hellman. In fact, it was done earlier in England in GCHQ. They eventually admitted that they had earlier found public key cryptography in one of the secret organizations. It's actually in Britain, GCHQ, I guess in Cheltenham and in England, but I guess sort of the British rough equivalent maybe of the NSA, which is sponsoring this one. So Whit Diffie and Marty Hellman came up, at least publicly, in the public world, with the idea of public key cryptography, and I'm going to talk a little bit at the beginning about Diffie-Hellman key agreement. So there, what happens is that Bob and I compute a shared secret without having exchanged a code book or secret in advance. So we're going to somehow put together a shared secret that then can be used as our one-time pad. And this is sort of maybe what happens on the internet when you're sending your credit card. You want to be able to use a one-time pad to encrypt and decrypt. How do you, the two of you, how do, you know, Amazon and you create this one-time pad? Well, you can do that using public key cryptography. So we're going to do a baby example of Diffie-Hellman using small numbers so that we can actually compute with them. If you really wanted it to be secure, you'd have to use very large numbers. And then we'll be here all night. So it's based on very simple mathematics, modular arithmetic. So modular arithmetic is something we all know because we tell time. So normally we have a 12-hour clock, and we're doing modular arithmetic after 12 o'clock. We don't get 13 o'clock, we get 1 o'clock. So 13 is the same as 1, 14 is the same as 2, 15 is the same as 3, and so on. That's arithmetic modulo 12. So modular arithmetic modulo 12. Or we could have, you can find anything on the internet. Here's a 24-hour clock. You can do modular arithmetic mod 24. So in Europe or in the military, you'd have a 24-hour clock, you might say, what happens at 1,400 hours. So that would be 2 in the afternoon. In my baby example, we're going to pretend we have an 11-hour clock. So we're going to do modular arithmetic modulo 11. So with our 11-hour clock, so modulo 11, 12 is the same as 1, 13 is the same as 2, 14 is the same as 3, and so on. And the numbers that I'm going to want you to remember, so 2 to the 4th, so 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 is what? What number? 16. 16 mod 11 is what? So if you had an 11-hour clock, 16, I guess I told you, is the same as 5. So remember that 2 to the 4th is the same as 5 mod 11, and 2 to the 6th is what number? 64. 64 in an 11-hour clock gives you 9. Okay. So remember, 2 to the 4th is 5, 2 to the 6th is 9. So just need that, I think, for one more slide. Okay, Diffie-Hellman key agreement. So Bob and I want to do Diffie-Hellman key agreement. We want to construct a shared secret. We, first of all, have to have some public information. This is information we could maybe announce on the radio or publish in the Washington Post or whatever. We don't care whether the rest of you know it. The public information for this example is going to be the number 2 and the fact that we're doing arithmetic modulo 11. Then I'm going to choose some secret number that I'm not going to tell anybody else. And it's some number I'll call A. Bob chooses his secret number. He'll call, you know, some secret number. Let's call it B. I'm going to take 2 to the power A, and then I'm going to reduce it mod 11. I'm going to figure out what number between 0 and 10 I get in my 11-hour clock when I take 2 to the A. Whatever number I get, that's the number between 0 and 10, I can shout it out. I can announce it publicly. Whatever I get is just something I make public or something I send to Bob, but I don't care if the rest of you intercept it. That's fine with me. Bob does the analogous thing with his secret B. So he takes 2, raises it to the power B, figures out what number that is mod 11. Okay, now I claim that there is something that Bob, some number that Bob and I can both compute that then becomes our shared secret key. This is our key agreement. We're agreeing on a secret key. But that the rest of you, at least if these numbers were a lot bigger, the rest of you would not be able to figure out. So what is that thing that he and I can easily compute that the rest of you can't compute?
Secret key.
So the product with what product? So if I take two today, so if I take what I send to Bob and what Bob sends to me, any of you have seen those and any of you can compute either that product or the sum or anything like that. So the product, the rest of you can compute. What is it that, so that was a good try.
2 to the AB.
2 to the AB. So how do I compute 2 to the AB?
You have A and you have 2 to the B.
Yeah.
I have 2 to the B. We all know 2 to the B. And I have A. So I can take 2 to the B and I can raise it to the power A and figure out what I get mod 11. And I know that number. And how does Bob compute that? He sees 2 to the A, he knows the secret B, so he can take 2 to the A, raise it to the Bth power, figure out what he gets mod 11. Okay, great. So he and I can compute this. So everyone agree, these two numbers are the same. So he and I can compute this. Now why can't the rest of you, so can the rest of you compute that number?
If it's mod 11.
So mod 11 you can. So how would you do that? So
you just... taking a look at the powers of 2 mm-hmm. mod 11 until you find it.
Okay, great.
Until you find the proper exponent.
Okay, great. Yeah, actually, let me quickly run through a slide with numbers just so we can see very concretely what's going on, and then I can actually get into this discussion later. Suppose my secret is the number 4, and the rest of you don't know this, and Bob's secret is the number 6. So then what am I sending to Bob? What number? So the 2 to the 4th mod 11, which you were supposed to remember, was 5. I told you I only had to remember for one slide. I lied. You have to remember for 2 slides. And what does Bob send to me or shout out in the room? What does he do? 2 to the 6th, which is 9. So he's sending 9. And then I take 9 and raise it to what power? So I take 9 to the 4th. I reduce it mod 11. And you can check the exercise. Check that that's 5. And Bob does what? He takes... takes 5, 2 to the 4th, he takes 5 and raises it to the 6th, and he gets, and you can check that that's also 5, and so our shared secret is 5. Okay, so suppose Eve, the eavesdropper, so suppose the rest of you, the eavesdroppers, want to figure out what the secret is. Well, so as was pointed out, you could take all the powers of 2 until you learn my secret. So I'm sending... So what was I sending? I was sending a 5. So you would take the powers of 2, and you see, the first power of 2 that gives me 5 mod 11 is 2 to the 4th. That means Alice's secret was 4. Once you know my secret, you can do everything I can do, and you can compute the shared secret. So what you need to do is replace 11 by a very large number. If you replace it by a large enough number, and this is what's actually done in practice, then you take it by a large enough number so that Eve would have to take hundreds of years to find my secret. So this is, in fact, what public key cryptography is based on. Remember, the one-time pad is the only completely secure crypto system. So public key cryptography is never secure. If you had enough computational power, you could always do a brute force attack and figure out the answer. So it's all based on the idea that computers are not good enough to solve these problems, to invert the one-way function. Unless you happen to have a quantum computer. So as soon as quantum computers exist, Diffie-Hellman key agreement becomes completely insecure. So to reiterate that, if we replace the number 11 by some large number, let's say P, it's normally going to be a prime number, and we replace our number 4 by some number X, what we're doing is computing 2 to the X mod P. Computing 2 to the X mod P is easy. But if you know 2 to the x mod p and you don't know x, figuring out what x gave you that is actually very hard. So here, Diffie-Hellman is based on the fact that given x, computing 2 to the x mod p is a one-way function. It's easy to do, and it's hard to invert. So it's easy for me to take my secret a and take 2 to the a mod p. It's hard for the rest of you to figure out my secret number a if all you know is 2 to the a mod p. So that's a one-way function that Diffie-Hellman is based on. So just briefly, I'll say torus-based cryptography is a generalization of this concept. So there are torus-based cryptography, there are systems called Luke, XTR, and Cayley. They're more efficient versions of Diffie-Hellman. They rely on mathematics of algebraic tori. So some of the history is that Arjen Lenstra and Erik Verhoel, two Dutch mathematicians, wrote a paper called the XTR public key system. And then Carl Rubin and I figured out what the mathematics underlying that system was, and we realized it was based on algebraic tori. And so what are XTR and Cayley? So I remember Cayley was the thing in the blackboard of the numbers episode. So this XTR cryptosystem has this little logo. So this is the difference between mathematicians and computer scientists. This is the sort of thing computer scientists would do, is they have this nice acronym. So what's the acronym XTR? And they have this nice logo, and they're great with the marketing aspect that mathematicians are not so good at. So XTR, what is XTR? XTR, they say, stands for, well, X is short for ECS. ECS is X. So XTR is really ECSTR. Which they say, well, their public statement is that it stands for efficient compact subgroup trace representation. Now, their secret thing is that it actually stands for elliptic curves still too risky. And we'll get to okay, but then Carl Rubin and I came up with this crypto system, and we decided it was, you know, in some ways better than XTR, generalized XTR. And I had a cat named Cayley, and there's a picture of Cayley. So that's Cayley. That's so. Some people actually call this the dead cat crypto system, but this was actually a memorial to Cayley, the wonderful cat. Cayley, how many people know the word Cayley, recognize the spelling? Okay, so it's basically, it's a Scottish, a Scots Gaelic word. It means sort of what we're having tonight. It's a gathering of people who get together and tell stories or sing or dance or have a party. This is, we could maybe call a Cayley. And I had a cat. Now, this is long before I was interested in cryptography. I named my cat Cayley because I was doing Scottish country dancing and loved the word. And then once you have a cat named Cayley with this bizarre DH at the end, well, it had to be DH for Diffie-Hellman. So this has to be compact efficient, improves on loop, and improves on Diffie-Hellman. Which, you know, as a mathematician, this is sort of a joke. But you thought, well, they can call theirs XTR, we can call this Cayley. And this is sort of maybe our logo, is you have Cayley and you have XTR, maybe in the cage. that's Cayley and that's XTR. And that's how we got Cayley. I think, what was it, like 11 million viewers saw that television show with Cayley in the middle of the blackboard, which is way, way more than the number of people who read any, you know, read all my papers put together. So, yeah, so there you can see the Cayley in the middle of the blackboard, Cayley in numbers, and you can see these are the equations that generalize the Diffie-Hellman that we've really seen. Okay, so that's torus-based cryptography, Diffie-Hellman, and then XTR and Cayley. Okay, so elliptic curve cryptography, well, so Diffie-Hellman is secure, but only up to a certain extent. And in fact, if you want to be even more secure, what you would do is you would use elliptic curves. And you would ignore the fact that some people have a cryptosystem that they think is called elliptic curves still too risky. Okay, so instead of using numbers modulo some prime number, so instead of using modular arithmetic, you would do Diffie-Hellman using Diffie-Hellman key agreement using elliptic curves, and I'll tell you a little bit about elliptic curves. Why would you do this? Well, with elliptic curves, Diffie-Hellman suddenly becomes more secure because the eavesdropper Eve has a harder time reversing the one-way function. So we don't know good algorithms for reversing the one-way function that corresponds to elliptic curve cryptography. While we do know some good polynomial, well, not polynomial, but sub-exponential time algorithms for solving the hard problem, the Diffie-Hellman problem. So in other words, inverting the one-way function. Okay, so a little bit of advertising for elliptic curve cryptography. So elliptic curve cryptography, because for the same security you can use smaller key sizes, it makes it especially good on so-called constrained devices. So mobile, wireless, small, so things like cell phones, pagers, handheld computers, microprocessors, smart cards. I sometimes carry a little smart card from Certicom that supposedly has an elliptic curve chip. Number of governments use elliptic curve cryptography, such as ours. So Certicom signed, which does elliptic curve cryptography, signed a deal with NSA. And at some point, NSA said, well, we used to be using this public key crypto system where we weren't going to tell you what it was. Now we've decided that we actually want everybody to be using elliptic curve cryptography as the public key cryptography. So elliptic curve cryptography, I found out recently that it's in nearly all flat screen TVs. It's in Windows Media Player, BlackBerry DVD players. I'm told it's in the FAA collision avoidance system, so I hope it's secure, because I want to get home safely. It protects biometric data and some passports, I think not in the US, but in other countries. Elliptic curve cryptography, I think in Europe, I think elliptic curve cryptography is used very extensively. Okay, so what is elliptic curve cryptography? What are elliptic curves? Well, so elliptic curve, it's a smooth cubic curve in the plane. So what do I mean by that? So very concretely, it's usually an equation of this form. So y squared is x cubed plus ax plus b, where a and b are some numbers. And I'm going to give you a very concrete example. So let's take y squared equals x cubed minus x, a very simple equation. If I were to graph it, I would get what we have here. Suppose I asked you, so as a number theorist, what I'm interested in maybe first of all would be, say, maybe integer solutions, whole number solutions, so x and y that satisfy this that are whole numbers, or maybe more generally rational numbers, say fractions. So suppose I asked you, so suppose I asked you for some solutions to this equation, what would you give me? What's that?
1, 0.
1, 0. So you're saying what, x is 1 and y is 0? Does everyone agree? So if I take 1 cubed minus 1, I get 0? So that okay? Okay, what else?
0, 0.
0, 0. Even more basic. So 0, 0 or 1, 0. Okay, anything else? Minus 1, 0. If everyone agree, take minus 1, you cube it, you get minus 1, then subtract minus 1 from it. Everyone agree? Minus 1, 0? Okay, what else? Find me more solutions. So I want x and y just have to be fractions, so rational numbers. What else?
You said rational numbers?
Yeah, rational numbers.
Why? Why not 2 root 6, 2 plus minus root 6?
Well, because then I get, well, then I get too many. Yeah. I'm a number theorist. Number theorists, you know, you start talking about, you know, integers, whole numbers, and then maybe you say, well, okay, we'll take quotients of whole numbers. So let's look at rational numbers. So let's just start with that. Nice, simple question. Yeah, so if you plug in, if you're willing to go outside the rational numbers, you can plug in anything for x, you get something on the right-hand side, you can take the square root and you get a solution. So we could do that, but let's make it more challenging. So can you find any other solutions?
I'm looking. I'm using a spreadsheet. I can't find any.
Anybody else? Can you find anything? Well, you're in good company, because neither could Pierre de Fermat, who showed that these are, in fact, the only rational number solutions. Not only that, but so many people know about the story of Fermat's last theorem and how he wrote in the margin of a book that he had a beautiful, a truly marvelous group. So this result, that these were the only rational solutions to that equation, that actually did fit in the margin of his copy of Diophantus, the proof of that result. So it's not immediate, it's not at all trivial, but he proved that these are in fact the only rational solutions. So anyway, this is my favorite elliptic curve, y squared equals x cubed minus x, and I think it's going to be in my examples. If we go back to our graph, we have that graph, and there are the points that you found. The reason that elliptic curves are so useful in cryptography is that they have an addition law on them. So you can take two points on the curve, and there's a natural way to associate to those two points a third point. So the same way you take two numbers and you can add them together, or you can take two numbers, you can multiply them together, you have some sort of operation that associates to two things another thing. There's a natural way to associate to two points on an elliptic curve a third point. And it's based on, so the addition law on an elliptic curve is based on the fact that a line meets a cubic in 3 points. So remember, this was y squared equals x cubed minus x. So it's a cubic. The highest exponent was the number 3. That's what makes it a cubic. Okay, so here we have a different, if I took a different elliptic curve, it might look like this. It wouldn't have the two components, it might have one component. I'll take one, maybe it looks like this. It doesn't matter. Take any elliptic curve. Suppose you take any two points on it. I'll call them P and Q. I want to define p plus q, this new newfangled additional auto lift occur. What do? I draw the line through P and Q. I get, remember, a line meets a cubic in 3 points. There's a third point of intersection, I'll call it R. I will then declare that P plus Q plus R, the sum of those 3 points, will sum to zero. Okay, at that point, so P plus Q plus R equals zero. What questions should you be asking me at this point? What are some questions you might want to ask? So you say that and say, okay, but...
Is it associative?
Okay, is it associative? What else, maybe even more basic than that?
X-coordinate?
What if there aren't 3 points on the line?
Well, there are in some sense. There are. The 3 points of intersection of the line with the cubic. A line will meet a cubic in 3 points. So there will be 3 points in some, but it, not, yes. So we'll get to that. That's maybe a more sophisticated question. We'll get to that maybe in a later slide. What else? Yeah.
Where's the point zero?
Where's the point zero? That's a good question. I say P plus Q plus R is zero. Where is zero? Okay, I'll tell you where zero is. Zero is right up there. Zero is at the point at infinity. It's the point where all vertical lines meet. So that's where zero is going to be. So I'm going to take my elliptic curve and I'm going to throw in this extra point. So it's if I took these points, I extended them, I tied them up at infinity, and that's the point zero. So it's the point where all vertical lines meet. So that's very good. That's the first question. That's where zero is. And what's another question you might ask? So I wanted to tell you what P plus Q was. So where's P plus Q? So P plus Q plus R is zero. So P plus Q is going to be minus R. So then you say, okay, but where is minus R? Okay, well, to get minus R, you take, remember, zero is the point where all vertical lines meet. It's the point at infinity. So if I take the vertical line through R, there are going to be 3 points of intersection. There's R, there's the point at infinity, there's this point down here. Those 3 points have to sum to zero. So they have to be zero, R, and minus R. This is minus R, and we said P plus Q is minus R. So the addition law on elliptic curve is defined this way. You take your points P and Q, you take the line through them, take the third point of intersection, take the vertical line through that, take the other point of intersection, that's P plus Q. That's our addition law on the elliptic curve. Okay. So that's why elliptic curves are so useful. But then there was the question, what happens if there aren't 3 points of intersection? So let's take this example. Here's another elliptic curve. It's not exactly, remember I said mostly it's y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b. It's a little different because it has an x squared term, but that's okay. It's still an elliptic curve. It's a non-singular cubic. You graph it, it looks like that. Can anybody find any points on that? Well, maybe I will tell you a point, actually. Let's take -1, 2. You can check. You always check me, maybe I did something wrong, but I claim that if you plug in x equals -1, y equals 2, you get a solution. Okay, so now, suppose I want to add that, so we know how to take, how to add 2 points together. What if I have a point and want to, if you want to do cryptography, you actually want to, remember in Diffie-Hellman, you wanted to take something to some power. Here you want to add something to itself many times. Suppose I take a point and want to add it to itself. Suppose I want to take this point and add it to itself. What should I do? I want to take the line through P and P. What is that?
Tangent.
That's the tangent line. So that's the line through P and P is the tangent line. So then you have a line where there are two intersections, only two intersections of the line with the cubic, but this one has multiplicity 2. This line is intersecting 1, 2, 3 points. That one of them has multiplicity 2. And this is multiplicity 1. So the third point of intersection is this point 1, 0. Suppose I want to add that point to itself. What do? I take the tangent at that point. That's now a vertical tangent. So what's the third point of intersection? It's the point at infinity, which we then can invert and still get the point at infinity. So I claim, so if we take, maybe I should go back a step. So if I take the point P, I add it to itself, I get that line, I get the third point of intersection, I then want to know, I then draw the vertical line, and I want to know what's the other point that I get on that line. And what do I have then? Well, this is the vertical line is a tangent line, so it's hitting this point twice, point at infinity once, which means the negative is this point. But think it through, I didn't say it very well, but exercise, check that. If you take that point, take twice that point, you get this one. And then if you do the same thing with this point, you get twice this point, which is now four times the original point, and we have four times p is zero. Exercise. Do that later. Do that at home. Okay. So we can, in other words, we can take a point and add it to itself, but what you have to do is take the tangent line to do that. If you want to do that, it's useful actually to see. So if you sat there and did the arithmetic, you can figure out equations that give you exactly what we described. So if I take an elliptic curve, y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, and I take my two solutions, my points p and q, let's say the first one has coordinates x1, y1, the second has coordinates x2, y2, I want to figure out what happens when I do this addition law. I'm going to get a point x3, y3. If you work through all that geometry and algebra, you can figure out that you get these equations. So here you have the slope of the tangent line through the two points, that's m, and you have in terms of m and x1, x2, y1, y2, you have these coordinates. So you can check that. And the nice thing about this is, it's just polynomial equations, so a computer can handle this. So you have an addition law, you have nice polynomial equations. That's exactly what an elliptic curve is. That's why you can do elliptic curve cryptography. There's a question about associative law. And in fact, that's something that's not at all easy to show, but in fact, it is an associative operation. So it is a group law. But I'll leave that as further research. You can try it on your own and look it up. Okay, now if we want to do elliptic curve cryptography, we don't want to look at the integer solutions or the rational number solutions. We want to do modular arithmetic on the elliptic curve. So we want to look at the solutions modulo 5. So let's go back to my favorite elliptic curve, y squared is x cubed minus x. If I ask you for the solutions modulo 5, what are you going to tell me? Give me some solutions modulo 5.
2, 1.
So somebody said 0, 0, 0, still a solution, right? So 0, 0 is still a solution, and what else?
4 zeros.
So 1, 1, 0, right? X is 1, y is 0. And we had before, we had what? -1, 0, but -1, as somebody said, is the same as
4.
So it's 4, 0 is another solution. Let's see. Yeah. So we have those solutions, right? 0, 0, 1, 0, 4, 0 are solutions modulo 5. What else? Is there anything else?
2, 1.
It's 2, 1. Does that work? Somebody want to check? I guess I agree with that. Do you agree? So if I take 2, 2 cubed is 8, minus 2 is 6, which modifier is 1. So, okay, so 2, 1, and if 2, 1 works, then also...
3, 2, 1.
If 2, 1 works, then I claim
2, 4
works, because that's 2 minus 1. And what else? Somebody said there was also 3...
3, 4. 3 cubed minus 3 is 24, which is 4 minus 5.
3 cubed... Let's see, so 3 cubed...
4, 2, 3 is 24,
which is 4. So you're saying what? 3, 2. Everyone agree 3 comma 2 works? And therefore also
3, 3.
So I agree with that. So we have those solutions, module 5, and you can keep checking and see that, in fact, that's all you get, except that, remember, I want you to throw in the point at infinity. And I'm going to leave as an exercise, if you take this point 2, 1 that you told me is on the curve, you can check that if you do your addition law on the elliptic curve using those equations that we had or using the idea that we had for how to do it, you can check that 2p is the point 0, 0, 3p is the point 2, 4, and 4p is the point at infinity. And you can also check that p plus this point is this point. And for those of you who know some group theory, you can figure out you have a group of order 8, and you can figure out which group of order 8 you have. And so for those of you who know about that, that will be your exercise, is what group of order 8 do you have. In any case, we have this point p that maybe I'll be using later, and we see 2p, 3p, 4p. Once we get to 4p, we're getting our 0. We're getting our 0 neutral element for the addition law. Okay, now we can do elliptic curve key agreement. So it's just the same as Diffie-Hellman, only with elliptic curves. So we, again, Bob and I need some public information. Instead of, before we had what? The number 2 and the fact that we did arithmetic mod 11. Now we're going to take some elliptic curve, say it could be my favorite elliptic curve, y squared is x cubed minus x, and we're going to say we're going to do arithmetic modulo something, modulo some q, where the elliptic curve and the fact that we're doing arithmetic mod q are all public information. And we take a point P on that elliptic curve. P is going to be the analog of the two that we had before. I again have a secret A, and Bob has a secret B. What do? I take my point P. Remember we had 2 to the A, mod 11. Instead of that, I now have an addition. Instead of multiplication of numbers, I'm now adding points on an elliptic curve. So I take the point P and I add it to itself A times. I get some, you know, using that addition law that we defined, I get some point on the elliptic curve, some x-coordinate and y-coordinate, and that's what I send to Bob. That's what I shout out in the room. So that's A times P. What does Bob do? He does the same thing with his secret. He takes the point P, he adds it to himself B times, he gets some point in the elliptic curve, and he announces that point. What is the point in the elliptic curve that Bob and I now share that Bob and I can both compute, that the rest of you hopefully can compute?
A plus B, P.
Is there a consensus? ABP. Did everyone agree? AB, very good. So how do I compute ABP? So I have the secret A, and the rest of you have also, you know, and we all have some other information. What do I do to compute ABP? I take the point that Bob said, BP, I add it to itself A times, right? And then I get A, that gives me ABP. And Bob takes what I sent, A times P. He's the only one who knows the secret little b. He adds that point to itself B times. He gets the same thing I got. And again, why can't E, the eavesdropper, figure out the shared secret? What does she see? She sees the elliptic curve E, the point P. She sees, you know, you all see AP, BP, but she doesn't know A or B, and it is believed to be very difficult to figure out what ABP is from, even if you have all that other information. So when people say that elliptic curve key agreement is secure, they say it's secure because it is based on the difficulty of the elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman problem. What does that mean? It's in fact a complete tautology. It simply means that it's hard to find ABP if you know EP, AP, and BP, but you don't know A or B. So in some sense, it is a belief. It's almost like a religious belief. We believe that this is a hard problem. If those of you in the audience who want to study more mathematics learn enough number theory to solve the elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman problem, you will have broken elliptic curve cryptography, and there are good and bad aspects of that, but at least you'll be very famous. Okay, so very briefly, pairing-based cryptography. So elliptic curve cryptography has been around since the mid-1980s. Pairings on elliptic curves have been around maybe since the 1940s. Number theorists have known them for a long time, and we've been very happy with them, but number theorists and cryptographers have only been speaking to each other fairly recently. And cryptographers somehow found out, hey, there are these pairings on elliptic curves. This is a new toy to play with, and they discovered that they can solve all sorts of very interesting unsolved problems using these things that these mathematicians knew about. So pairings, what are pairings? I will give you a very simple example in a minute, but let me first say what pairings are. So we take an elliptic curve. We take a point P on that elliptic curve. So it's some solution to that equation. So x-coordinate, y-coordinate, that's our point P. I take P, I use my addition law, I get 2P, 3P, 4P, and so on. Addition modulo some number. Eventually, I get the point at infinity. We'll call that KP. And so this set with the brackets P, that's all the multiples of P, P, 2P, and so on. Now, for certain elliptic curves, there's a pairing which takes two. So these are, what do we have? This set is all the multiples of P. A pairing takes two multiples of P and produces, so if K was the first thing that gave you 0, KP equals 0, the pairing takes two multiples of P and produces a kth root of unity. So something such that when you raise it to the kth power, you get 1. Modulo whatever you're looking at. Okay, so I'll give you a simple example of that. But what are the properties that we need to have? So what does the pairing do? It takes one multiple of P and another multiple of P and gives me a kth root of unity. I want that kth root of unity to have the property that if I paired P with P and raised it to the power AB, I'd get the same thing as if I just paired AP and BP. So this is called the bilinearity property. So this is a function that we want to be bilinear, and this is what I mean by bilinear. If I want to be doing good cryptography using computers, I want this pairing, this map, to be efficiently computable. There's one other thing that I want. So if I say these are the properties I want, there's a trivial solution to this problem. There's a trivial function. What's that trivial function? Something that takes any two multiples of P and associates to them something that's very efficient to compute and has the property that you raise it to the power k and you get 1, namely 1. So I could take the map. An easy solution to this is take the map that takes any two multiples of the point P, any two things in this set, and associates to those two things the number 1. That would be something that we could do here. But that would be trivial, and you're not going to get a lot of good cryptography from that. So we simply declare that it's not the map 1. And in fact, you can just say it does, if P and P don't pair to 1, that's going to be our condition. OK, so this is what you want. You want these properties. You want some function, takes two multiples of P, sends it to some number, and you want it to have some nice properties. Baby example. So let's go back to our elliptic curve. Y squared is x cubed minus x. We'll do arithmetic mod 5. You told me that 2, 1 was such a solution. So P will be the point 2, 1. And remember, your exercise was that the multiples of P were, so we start at P. Remember, this was 2P, this was 3P, this was 4P. So this is the set we're looking at. Mod 5, so we're looking now at, so our K, so this is P, 2P, 3P, 4P. This was, remember, it was KP, so K is 4. So we're looking at fourth roots of 1. Modulo 5, the fourth roots of 1 are 1, 2, 3, and 4, because, well, 1 to the 4th is 1. 2 to the 4th is, you told me that was 16, which mod 5 is 1. 3 to the 4th, what's 3 to the 4th?
81.
81, which is mod 5 is 1, and so on. 4 to the 4th is 1. So those are the fourth roots of 1, mod 5. So I want a function, I want a function that takes my two points on the curve and gives me, well, it gives me a fourth root of unity. In other words, it gives me 1, 2, 3, or 4 mod 5. I claim if I run, and I want it to be efficiently computable, which basically means I want it to be given by some nice polynomial, like this one. So we take, it turns out if you take this, if you take this function, it turns out to have all the right properties. So I'll remind you what those properties are, because we're going to use those properties. So I claim that thing that I wrote down, you don't have to know what it is, it's just something, some nice polynomials. It's efficiently computable because it's just given by a nice polynomial. It's a map that takes two multiples of P and sends it to 1, 2, 3, or 4, mod 5. You can check that. And you can also check that if you plug in the point 2, 1, that was our point P, plug in that as both the first and second coordinate, you get the number 2. And if you take any multiples, you take AP and BP, plug them in, you get 2 to the AB mod 5, which is the same as pairing P with itself and taking that to the AB mod 5. And that was our bilinearity property. So I'm just, you can check that if you had to, but I'm telling you it turns out that's the case. So you have the bilinearity property, it's efficiently computable, and it's not trivial because you pair P to itself, you don't get 1, you get 2. So it's not trivial. Okay, so recall these are the conditions that we want. Okay, so now that you have those conditions, why is that a good thing? What does that allow you to do? Okay, well, according to Antoine Ju, what it does is allow, instead of Diffie-Hellman, where you have just me and Bob trying to construct a shared secret, three people, three parties can share a secret, broadcasting information only once, as we did in Diffie-Hellman. But in order to do that, you need pairings. You need to have this complicated pairing thing. So suppose Bob and Kaylee and I want to construct a shared secret. So what do? We start out the same way as in Diffie-Hellman. So I have my secret A, Bob has his secret B, Kaylee has her secret C, and I broadcast just as we did before in regular elliptic curve cryptography. I take the point P on the elliptic curve, add it to itself A times, figure out what point on the elliptic curve I get, some x-coordinate, some y-coordinate. I broadcast that. Bob does the analogous thing, he broadcasts BP, Kaylee broadcasts CP. Okay, now the question is, what is the thing that Bob and Kaylee and I can all construct that the rest of you cannot? I guess I might want to write something on the board. So. Any conjectures? So if you think of something that the three of us can compute, and that the rest of you hopefully cannot. And there's a hint. Yeah.
A, B, C, P squared.
So what do you mean? So A, B, C like that, and then what do you mean by P squared? So this is actually
E-F-P-P.
Yeah. So you were definitely on the right track.
E of P P.
What's that? So the hint is, remember I said this is a problem that could not be solved without pairings. So you better be using the pairing. This is an unsolved problem before people knew about pairing. So you want to be using the pairing. And as you say P squared, what I think you mean is you want to be pairing P with P, which I've been writing as take this function. So E of P P.
That's exactly what
you mean. E of P P. And so what do I want? So you're saying this, right? So that's what you want. So what do people think?
Make it an exponent.
So why not this?
Make it an exponent.
Yeah, so is this okay? So what's wrong with this? What's wrong with this is which aspect? Can
you don't know A, B, and C.
Is that we don't know how to compute this. And I don't know how to compute this, even though I know my secret A. But you're claiming now, so here's the one. This is conjecture one. Conjecture two was what? What is your conjecture?
Raise it to the ABC power.
Okay, so what do people think of that? Does that work?
Yeah.
Well, why does that work? So how do I compute this?
So you have
take E of BP and ABP.
So what do? I take
CP.
I pair BP with
CP.
So all of you know BP, all of you know CP. And so I can do this.
Raise it to the
eighth power. I raise it to the eighth power, and only I can do that. Right. So this is some number. K through divinity, mod something, and I can make it and raise it to the power. Okay, I can compute this. Why is it the same as this?
Bilinearity.
So bilinearity says these things you can pull up. I can take this, I can pull it up. I can take this, I can pull it up. So these are equal. I can compute this. It's the same as that. And what does Bob do to compute it?
CP.
And then bilinearity says you can pull these up and get this. And what does Kaylee do?
AP
and raise it to the C of powers. Everyone agree? So that's the clever use of pairing. So this is why I had to make you sit through seeing what pairings were. The point is they have this bilinearity property, and they're efficiently computable, and they're not trivial. And therefore, three parties can share a secret with one broadcast. Okay. And we can compute it that way. So the security now, so we're almost done. The security relies on what? Well, again, basically it's a tautology. Siebel said, it relies on the difficulty of the bilinear Diffie-Hellman problem, where the bilinear Diffie-Hellman problem simply says that was what we did was secure. It says, given P, AP, BP, and CP, which are all these public things that are running around that all of you see, it's difficult to compute the shared secret if you don't know any of the individual secrets. So that's the bilinear Diffie-Hellman problem. This is actually part of a trend that's been going on for a while in pairing-based cryptography, as long as pairing-based cryptography has been around, which is, let's solve this wonderful unsolved problem. Let's solve it using pairings. Whoops, we have to now say what the security is based on. Well, it's based on this new thing that we'll give a name to. It'll be the symmetric, asymmetric, extended, bounded, blah, 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 Diffie-Hellman problem, which is basically a problem that just says the thing we just created is secure. But what number theorists need to do is check, is this secure? Can we solve this problem? Can we find an algorithm? You know, is this really secure, or is this just a pipe dream? Is this just wishful thinking? So, I will maybe just ask the question, can four people share a secret after one broadcast? And this is an open question. We don't know how to do this using elliptic curves, using pairings, using anything. We would probably need new mathematics, maybe something coming from topology or who knows where to solve this problem. And for lack of time, I'm going to skip because you were all asking such good questions. Yeah, so maybe I'll, this is basically what I just said. Many clever new crypto systems are being created using pairings of elliptic curves, and the security is based on brand new so-called hard problems. You know, we have the Diffie-Hellman problem. We have the elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman problem. We have the bilinear Diffie-Hellman problem, which simply just say the new thing we've created is secure. They haven't been scrutinized by mathematicians very much, and this is something that should be done. Open questions are, how difficult are these new hard problems? Are they as hard as the old problems that people believed were hard? So presumably NSA either believes that elliptic curve cryptography is secure, or they believe that only they can break it. And so it would be interesting to know, you know, how hard are these new hard problems? Can you solve four-party Diffie-Hellman? And once people build quantum computers, everything we've talked about today is totally broken. So can you find public key crypto systems that are resistant to attacks by quantum computers? And people are working on the mathematics behind that. So the mathematics of public key cryptography so far has been number theory, algebra, algebraic geometry, and presumably there are other fields of mathematics out there that would also be useful for solving some of the open problems. And if you want to know more about pairings, I suggest go Google the pairing-based crypto lounge, and you'll find a lot of information about pairing-based cryptography. And I think it's probably a good time to end, and I'll take questions.